Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Do you search for meaning in your work? Perhaps that searching is the reason why the average American worker changes jobs every 4.6 years. Actually, it may surprise you to know job loyalty has increased in the last 30 years. In 1983, we changed jobs every 3.5 years. But according to Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce, people are holding on to their jobs not because they want to, but because they don't have as much opportunity as they once did. So where does that leave our search for meaningful, gainful employ? Our guest on this episode of Speakers Forum went from troubled youth to Rhodes Scholar, U.S. Army paratrooper to White House fellow, Wall Street banker to renowned author and television host. That's a brief synopsis of the life path of Wes Moore so far. He came to fame in 2010 when his first book, The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates, became a New York Times bestseller. In it, Moore explores the commonalities and fateful differences between his life and the life of another young man with the same name. It became a common read, books read and discussed by all incoming freshmen at many colleges. Moore's new book is The Work, My Search for a Meaningful Life. In it, he shares wisdom gathered in his wide journey from friends and innovators who inspired him. The book explores service, self-discovery, risk-taking, success, and the path toward a meaningful life. Town Hall Seattle, Elliott Bay Book Company, and the Northwest African American Museum presented this event on January 19, 2015, as part of the Civic Series. Sponsors include Boeing, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Thanks to Anna Tatasheff for this recording.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and good evening, 12s. I just say, even not being from Seattle, I was yelling and screaming in those last 4 minutes, man. That was some great football. So y'all have a lot to be proud of, but it really is just an absolute honor to be back in Seattle. I mean, this really is just it's a great city. It's a place where there are great things happening. There's still work that needs to be done, but there's no shortage of people who are anxious to do the work. And that's really cool. That's really exciting. And I think it's just incredibly telling and appropriate and exciting for me to have the launch of this new project entitled The Work and to be here so soon after the launch of it. Because in many ways, this story and this book was a very personal journey that I just decided to share with a larger community. And the way this story and the way The Work first began and first came out was it actually, in some ways, is a continuation of my first book, The Other Wes Moore. And that first book, The Other Wes Moore, for those who don't know, it was a story about how the day after I had just received the Rhodes Scholarship, the Baltimore Sun, which is my hometown paper, wrote a piece on my life. And well, first they wrote a piece on the Rhodes Scholarship and how this local kid had just received this award, this Rhodes Scholarship. And in the article, they talked a bit about what the scholarship was, but they also talked a bit about my life and how my life has, how I got into quite a bit of stuff as I was younger and didn't have the most straight line path. But how, with a lot of help and a lot of support and a lot of people who believed in second chances, I was able to change in azimuth and receive this award. The same time, they're writing a whole series about four guys who walked into a jewelry store. And how the first two guys walked in the jewelry store and they pulled out guns. And the second two guys walked in 10 seconds later and they pulled out mallets. And how the ones with the guns were keeping everybody on the ground while the ones with the mallets were walking around and smashing out jewelry cases and taking out watches and rings and necklaces while everybody who was inside the store just kept their heads down and they listened as the glass kept on smashing around them. And after being in the store for about 35 seconds, they managed to get a little over $400,000 worth of jewelry. And one of them yelled, "Let's go." All four ran out of the center of the store, ran outside. And in the process, when they ran outside and they were trying to get away, an off-duty police officer tried to stop them. And this off-duty police officer was a 13-year veteran of the Baltimore Police Force. He was a three-time recipient of Police Officer of the Year. He was also a father of five who just had triplets. And the reason he was working that day was because it was his day off from the police force, and he took on a second job as a security guard to make extra money for his family. And in the process of him running outside to try to stop them, he was kneeling next to a car to see if he could stop the guys from getting away, and he didn't realize that one of the cars that he was kneeling next to was one of the cars that the guys ran, and he was shot three times at point-blank range and killed instantly. And there was a 12-day national manhunt for those four guys. Finally, after 12 days, all four guys were caught. And one of the people that the police were looking for that was eventually captured and tried and convicted and sentenced for the crime was this guy whose name was also Wes Moore. And the more I learned about him, the more I learned how much more we had in common than just our names. And I reached out to him. And I wrote him a letter. And that one letter turned into dozens of letters. Those dozens of letters turned into dozens of visits. And then I have now known Wes for about a decade. The origins of the other Wes Moore was trying to understand that space between success and failure. To try to understand what happens that you have two people that are literally living blocks away from each other, who both come from single-parent households, who both have academic and disciplinary troubles and all these things. But what happens as these two kids are growing up that eventually causes this split? And what was interesting and how it really dovetailed into this work was when I was speaking with my publisher, you know, they said one of the most common questions we get about the other Wes Moore is people want to know what happened next. You know, they say, you know, since the end of the book, you know, you've fought in Afghanistan, you've worked inside the White House, you've worked in finance as the financial crisis was going on. You've done all these other things, but you don't write about any of that inside the other Wes Moore. Now, there's a reason for it. There's a reason why we stopped the book so abruptly in 2000 in the first book. It's because I try to give equal weight to both of those two stories, literally to the point of page count. I think the page count difference between my story and Wes's story and the other Wes Moore is 4 pages, right? I wanted to give equal weight to both of those two stories. To do that post-2000 is impossible. I can write about Wes's life in a paragraph since 2000. I have not spoken with Wes today, but I can tell you simply by looking at a clock or looking at a watch what he is probably doing right now, simply because I know his schedule and it has not changed in 13 years. He's now in year 13 of a life sentence. And so when they said, "What do you think about writing about what you're kind of doing now and what it, and the success that you've seen?" I wasn't quite sure what to say. Because if the understanding of the first story was really that space between success and failure, I really wanted to examine what does success mean in the first place. What does it mean to actually find success? And one thing that I realized is that success without mattering is not really success at all. Where I felt like over the past decade there was this constant search to find something that felt real, something that felt meaningful, something that felt right, something that felt like you were actually making a marked difference. And what then ended up happening in these stories was when you show how not just the adventures but the misadventures led to how I actually define the work. And how I define the work now is it's when your greatest joys and your greatest gifts actually begin to start overlapping with the world's greatest needs. And then you actually do something about it. That's something I don't even think I fully grasped, even when the publisher first asked me about these stories. And I'll read a kind of a small part from the book to kind of show you. This is around where I was when they first even brought up this idea of writing this. And the context of it is I was working in my job in finance. And I was working down on Wall Street. And I went to go see my grandparents who lived in the South Bronx, in the same city, but in completely different worlds. And this is where we were. One day while I was spending a month in New York working on a deal, I took the 40-minute subway ride up to the Bronx. The subway system in New York is amazingly efficient at showing off the jarring disparities between neighborhoods. One ride can bring you to the underbelly, from the underbelly of poverty to the pinnacle of affluence, all for the price of a cup of coffee. I learned the route by heart. The number 2 train took me directly from my office on Wall Street to my grandparents' house off Gun Hill Road in the Bronx. The train rolled beneath the towering buildings of Lower Manhattan, the neon lights of Midtown, the urban suburbia of the Upper West Side, and the teeming street life of Harlem. 40 minutes after leaving an odorless, glass-sheathed downtown monolith, my nose was filled with the smell of oxtail and pig's feet as I walked into my grandparents' home. Some folks would literally turn up their noses at our family's choice of cuisine. But for me, it was comfort food. When I sat at my grandparents' dining room table and took the first large bite of gelatinous hoof, it was as if it would have been seasoned with memory and marinated with love. "So how's work?" Mama Wynn's eyes danced and pride dripped from her voice as she asked me the question. I had not fallen into any of the traps that lay outside their front door. I had survived my first 24 years when so many black men's lives were snuffed out, and a kind of communal gratitude surrounded me, as it did every time I went home. "It's going fine. I'm working hard," I replied between bites. "Now tell me again, what is it exactly that you do?" my grandfather asked. This made me pause my energetic chewing for a moment. I wasn't sure exactly what to tell him. I was a banker, but that's not really what he was asking. He knew I worked at a bank. His question was less about the title and more about, well, the work. In some ways, he was asking me the question I had been avoiding asking myself. I thought quickly. I was proud of the fact that, as I had been taught and repeated over and over in the halls of the bank, we added liquidity to the markets. Liquidity ensured that businesses and governments had the capital they required to serve the needs of their clients and constituents. This was not shameful work. It was essential, at least in the system as it currently exists. I knew my lines, but I didn't know how to share them with my grandparents. They had lived in the same home for almost half a century. My grandfather led congregations, and my mother led classrooms. Their pride was in the honesty and necessity of their labor, not just in the particularly complex economic system of the 21st century, but in a deeper, timeless way. People need faith. They need education. They always will. And that's what my grandparents did. They worked for other people in the most profound sense. That was what gave them their sense of pride. They were proud of me too. Their pride was constant and powerful, even though they had no idea what I actually did. They were just proud that I was doing something, that I was trying. Before I could answer my grandfather's question, I was saved by my grandmother. She smiled at my grandfather and said, "Dear, you know he works at a bank. In fact, I'm going to tell Miss Johnson that she should go do her deposits with you." Mrs. Johnson was a neighbor who'd lived down the street from my grandparents for 35 years. My grandmother thought that I was a bank teller, that I could enter deposits on the 1st and 15th of the month and get people the cash from their paychecks. She had no idea that I wouldn't know what to do with Mrs. Johnson's deposit slip. And she had no idea that Mrs. Johnson probably couldn't even get in to give it to me anyway, because she couldn't get past security in my building. So when the publisher first came up and said, I want you to write about success, it forced me to pause for a second and ask, what exactly does that mean? Where so much of our success comes from this idea of being great. That's a definition of success. And when you really think about it, people who are really great at what they do, I mean really great at what they do, there's something that each and every one of them have in common. It's not where they came from. It's not their profession or their occupation. It's not what neighborhoods or what type of family they came from or what part of the country or what part of the world they originate from. It's that they care passionately about what they do. And I realized at that moment that the only way that you can ever be great is if you care deeply about your work. And if you know how that work then translates and resonates into serving the lives of others. This journey of not just explaining it and defining it, but showing it, was a personal journey. And one that I more firmly understand because also in addition to highlighting how that navigated over the past decade in my own life, I then wanted to show what it meant in the lives of other people who have found their work. So in these stories, I talk about a woman named Kara Alley, a woman who was born and raised by a single mom in Boston. And how when Kara was 14 years old, her mom received a phone call letting her know that she now had a job. And how that phone call, that one phone call, and that one job that Kara's mother got, without realizing it, changed the entire trajectory of their family. Kara later on finished up school and became an entrepreneur. And one business that Kara started was a business called American Mojo, where it was basically a clothing company, an apparel company. And she called the business American Mojo for this reason. The Mojo stood for mothers and jobs. Because the only people that Kara hires in her business are single mothers who live in poverty. That's all she'll hire, from the very top of the organization to the bottom of the organization. And she does it for two reasons. She does it because she loves the feeling and the sound of the woman's voice when Kara calls her to tell her, I'll see you on Monday. And she did it as a tribute to her mother. Kara had found her work, and Kara understood that her occupation, while it doesn't necessarily have to be your work, because those are two very exclusive things, it can be. I talk about a guy named Michael Hancock. Michael Hancock was born and raised in Denver, Colorado, in a very abusive household where he was getting shuttled back and forth between family members and aunts and uncles. Michael saw every form of abuse as he was growing up in Denver. And he had one definition of success as he was growing up: leave Denver. Everything negative about his life, he directly correlated to the city that he called home. And so he knew that the one day when he could say, I'm actually doing something with myself, the one day when I can say I've made it, is the day when I can walk out of this city and never see it again. Michael Hancock is currently the mayor of Denver, Colorado. Because Michael, or Mayor Hancock, understood that sometimes the thing that frightens you the most, sometimes your greatest fear, is a thing that you need to run into with all of your aggression and all of your heart. Michael Hancock understood that who would he be to turn around and look at every single young person who's growing up in Denver, Colorado, and say, despite everything I've seen, I have nothing to give you? Who would Michael Hancock be if he did not take his talents and his gifts and put it towards the place that he felt needed it the most? I talk about two buddies of mine named John Galena and Dale Beatty, who grew up in Statesville, North Carolina together. They graduated from high school together. They ended up joining the Army right out of high school. And as they joined the Army, they first joined the National Guard, and John was a, Dale was a general contractor, and John was a chef at the Cracker Barrel. Not a cook, as he says, a chef at the Cracker Barrel. And after doing that for a couple of years, 9/11 had happened, and they both decided that they wanted to go on active duty, that they both joined active duty and went to the military together, and ended up deploying to Iraq. And one day, as they were driving in a convoy, and they're in a Humvee, and John was driving the Humvee, and Dale was sitting in the passenger seat, an IED went off right next to their Humvee, blowing the vehicle 20 feet into the air. As John was knocked out as he was driving the vehicle, as he came to, he looked over to the side, and he saw his best friend dying next to him. The medics were able to come in, and they were actually able to save Dale's life, but they were not able to save his legs. And Dale was sent back home to Statesville, North Carolina. He was brought back to a hero's welcome by the community. But the person who was also severely injured in that vehicle was John. Except John was the only one in the vehicle without any physical injuries. So John ended up having very serious survivor's guilt, PTSD, traumatic brain injury. And also John eventually became suicidal. And the only person who noticed it was Dale. And one day Dale goes over and goes to see John, and John always blamed himself because John was like, it was my fault because he was the one driving the vehicle. And Dale went over to go see him, and Dale says, you know how you always say if there's anything that I need to let you know? And John says, anything, if there's anything you need, let me know, it was my fault. And Dale says, first of all, it wasn't your fault. And he said, second of all, I need your help. And he said, what? And he said, I want to build homes for service-disabled veterans who need them. And John kind of pauses and he looks at Dale and he says, how are you going to build homes? You have no legs. And Dale says, but you do. And they first began by building a little ramp for a Vietnam veteran who they knew who lived in Statesville, North Carolina, and eventually started an organization called Purple Heart Homes, which now goes around the country building homes for service-disabled veterans. These two guys from Statesville, North Carolina. They have found their work. And what I wanted to show with this process and what I wanted to show with this journey that kind of really does take you through a whole illumination of living overseas during 9/11 to then eventually going and serving overseas in Afghanistan to coming back and working inside of the White House and then working in finance and then eventually coming back and doing some of the work that we do right now in higher education and higher education reformation. But then also highlighting these other individuals who've inspired me along the way actually goes back to the words of Dr. King as we celebrate him today, when he said, everybody can be great because everybody can serve. How our truest work and our truest gifts come when we both fall in love and lose ourselves in service for something bigger than ourselves. When we have a clear understanding that we have a finite amount of time here, but in the time that we do have here, it's important to live in a way that we know that even while we're gone, our acts should not leave as well. Our contributions should stay long after we're no longer here to see them anymore. That's our work. And I remember as I was going through the, when I was returning back to the world of finance and speaking with one of my mentors, a gentleman named Bill Brody, when I told him I was going back and working in finance, he told me something that I'll never forget. When I first told him I was going back there, I thought he'd be excited. I said, yeah, I'm going back and I'm working on this issue. And he said, really? And I said, that's not the reaction I thought you'd give me. And he said, why do you want to do it? And I explained to him why I wanted to go through this process, because I wanted a skill set and I had responsibilities for my family and all these other things. And he said, listen, Wes, I'm never going to judge what you do. I'm never going to judge your reasons for going to do whatever it is that you want to do. But all I say is that the moment you think that you've gotten everything you need to get out of there, leave. Because with every day you stay longer, you become extraordinarily ordinary. His point was not an indictment on an industry. His point was not an indictment on the world of finance. His point is that if you're not actively searching for your work, and if you're not living your passion, then you can never be great. That's all we hope that people would take away from this, is that each one of us have been blessed with an ability to do something special. And then it just becomes up to all of us to determine what that is and to go do it. I'll close with a very small part from a place in the end of the book, because that's what authors do when they go places. They read. And a context from this actually comes from actually is very appropriate today, when Dr. King was arrested in Birmingham. And as he and Ralph Abernathy and others were arrested in Birmingham, how the first night that he spent in jail, the next morning he woke up and someone handed him an op-ed that was written about him. And the op-ed was written by a collection of clergy. And in this op-ed, they basically went on to talk about how Dr. King and his actions were unwanted and unwarranted. And they called him an outside agitator in this op-ed, and they told him that he was doing more harm than good by coming into Birmingham because he was not from there. And Dr. King responded to them by writing his op-ed basically in the margins of the paper, and that little op-ed, that little response that he wrote back to the clergy is now what we all know as a letter from a Birmingham jail. And in that letter, he began to tell them, he starts the letter by thanking them for writing the op-ed. And he said, but if I responded to every single negative thing that was written about me, I would never have any time to do my actual work. But he said, but I'll take time to respond to you because since you're members of the clergy, I'm assuming you're coming from a place of love, so I'm going to respond to you from a place of love. And then he spent the entire letter dismantling every single argument that they made. It's a brilliant, brilliant letter. The reason I bring that up, though, is because when Dr. King was sitting in that Birmingham jail, he received notification that he was being bailed out, and the person who bailed him out was Harry Belafonte. I was guest co-hosting Morning Joe one morning, the MSNBC staple that kicks off the cable channel's morning programming. Sitting with Willie Geist, a good friend and one of the most talented people on television, I looked over the schedule of events and saw that Harry Belafonte was going to be a guest in the 8 o'clock hour. Mr. Belafonte was revered in my home when I was growing up. Of Jamaican descent, he introduced the world to his unique West Indian mix of fun-loving calypso and soulful ballads. He was also a heartthrob and a fine actor, and his combination of talents made him a star. But my grandparents' admiration for him went well past his Jamaican heritage, his smooth baritone, or, in my grandmother's case, his tight pants. They admired him because he was passionate about making his celebrity mean something. What many didn't realize was that when Mr. Belafonte was not entertaining crowds, he was supporting many of the important civil rights issues of the day. When Martin Luther King Jr. needed someone to bail him out of the Birmingham jail, it was Harry Belafonte who came to his aid. Belafonte staked his personal wealth and risked his career to support Dr. King and the civil rights movement. Indeed, Belafonte suffered professionally. He was blacklisted and targeted by the FBI, but he never stopped. His activism continued for decades, helping raise money for humanitarian interventions all over Africa, working to bring down apartheid, and speaking out against American wars, including the one I'd fought in myself. He was a brilliant entertainer who leveraged his fame and wealth for the things he believed in, even when it cost him. As Mr. Belafonte slowly strode onto the set, his still regal frame and smooth skin and youthful features belied the fact that this was a man in his mid-80s. He smiled, showing off the legendary grin that had won him millions of fans. We shook hands, and soon we were live on air. He was talking about the new book he had completed about his life. He spoke about his entertainment career, but the conversation quickly turned to politics and the midterm elections that were fast approaching. He spoke with more passion about health disparities and economic inequality than he did about his performances at Radio City or Carnegie Hall. When it came time for me to pose a question, I asked him where his underlying passion for social issues had come from. Was it his immigrant history? Maybe his interracial marriage helped to shape his outlook. Was it living through the civil rights era and seeing how many of the people who were listening to his songs were still drinking from separate water fountains and eating at separate food counters? He broke out into his famous grin again and softly chuckled. He told me, "It was just more fun to live that way." That wasn't the answer I'd been expecting. "Think about it," he continued. "Some celebrities wake up and call their accountants. I wake up and I call Nelson Mandela. Who do you think has a more interesting life?" So much of finding our work is understanding we're just searching for a more interesting life. We're just searching for the chance to do something meaningful and to have joy in that meaning. Our work doesn't have to be selfless. Our work can also simply be selfish because, as Mr. Belafonte said, it helps us to live a more interesting life. Going through this process, sharing these stories, and finding my own work in all of that has been one of the great joys of my life. The only greater joy now is continuing to fill what that work is. I'm incredibly thankful for not just the time tonight, but for the inspiration that I draw from it. Bless you, and thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank y'all. Thank you. Y'all are so sweet. Thank you very much. And I just say too, and seriously, this is a very big deal for me, because even coming here, it's like, I mean, I know y'all usually get people like, you know, Howard Schultz and Steve Brill and like Mozart's birthday celebration. So thanks for lowering your standards for an evening and coming to hear me. But I would be humbled and honored if anybody has any thoughts or comments or questions about the work, about The Other West Moore, about the stuff we're working on now, about current events, about Super Bowl predictions, whatever you got. I'd be humbled and honored and excited to answer any of them as well. Oh, I was reminded to, if people do have questions, if they could speak into the microphone so y'all audio can get picked up. But if you can't do that, I can just repeat your question as well.
Hi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Am I on? I was really glad in the introduction that she mentioned that you work for Condoleezza Rice. Yeah. And so it kind of cast a through line for me about passion. and that line between passion and grandiosity. And I'm just really, you know, curious about that, because our passion, I'm very passionate about the work I do in the world. And I imagine people in the Bush White House were also very passionate about the decisions they made. So I'm really curious about that intersection between humility and passion and actually asking for forgiveness for our mistakes.
Great question. So thank you for that. And first, so let me give context what actually brought me to Washington. I was in Afghanistan, and I just come back from a night mission. And it was a difficult deployment on a lot of different levels. But after I just came back from this mission, one of my NCOs, a guy named Sergeant Johnson, who was awesome, came up to me. He's like, "Hey, sir, Colonel Fenzel needs to see you." Colonel Fenzel was a guy named Mike Fenzel, who was one of my good friends, had been one of my good friends for years. And he was the deputy brigade commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, which was my unit. And Mike, in many ways, was the reason that I was in Afghanistan, because I was actually working in working in finance in London. And I got a phone call one day from Mike. And Mike was like, "You know, how's it being one of those masters of the universe?" And I was like, "It's cool." I said, "They work pretty hard here." And Mike's reaction was, "I'm sure they do." And I'm talking to a guy who was a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne Division. And that's when he told me, he's like, "You know, are you ever going to get into the fight?" Because I trained with Mike and had eventually, you know, done all my airborne training. And Mike was now on his third deployment. And I was still on none. And then eventually, I'll fast forward and I talk a little bit about it in there. But, you know, I ended up joining up, linking up with the 82nd Airborne, was now in Afghanistan fighting with him. And when Mike called me in, he called me in to see how things are going. And then he told me, he said, "You need to apply for a White House fellowship." And I knew Mike was a former White House fellow. And he said the reason that he believed that was this. He said, "Because the people in Washington need to know what you've been seeing over these months. They need to know what you now know." And I ended up applying for this fellowship and ended up getting the fellowship. And the White House fellowship is it's a non-political, non-partisan fellowship, but where you spend a year working as a senior level advisor to a cabinet level secretary. And they do it because they want to bring outside people who don't have politics or political backgrounds to see how the political process works. And it was interesting because I think one of the big takes, and I ended up being placed with the Secretary of State, partially because of my background in both international affairs and finance. And so they had me focusing a lot on foreign assistance and foreign aid and trying to add quantifiable effects to the money that's then given away to other countries, and how exactly do we know what's working, how exactly do we know what's useful, et cetera. And there's a couple big takeaways that I took from that year working in Washington, going back to that question. One is the amazing disconnect that sometimes exists between those who make the policy and those who actually have to implement it. How oftentimes the two never speak. And policies are then created based on theories. Policies are then based on ideologies. Policies are made based on predictions. But oftentimes, understanding what the impacts of those policies are, it takes a long time for that information to roll uphill. Another thing that I think I did genuinely take away from that experience, though, is I think I walked into Washington a lot more cynical than I walked away from it. You know, I think I walked away believing that Washington actually has an ability to be incredibly potent when it's at its best, has an ability to be incredibly impotent when it's at its worst. But the people who are doing this work, for the most part, really have, and I think about the things that they're sacrificing in order to do it, is actually pretty remarkable. You know, people who are up at, like the secretary who's up at 4 o'clock in the morning and at the State Department by 6, at the White House by 7 for the PDB, and kind of goes at that pace until about 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night when she finally went home. And while there were times when I definitely disagreed with the conclusion, there were quite a few times when I disagreed with the conclusion, I at least began to understand and respect the process in which we draw those conclusions. I'm a person who firmly believes that when you go to a person and ask them, or you say to them, well, you felt this way in 1985 and you feel a certain way now, or whatever the case might be, that if a person has altered their opinion or a person alters their views because new information is introduced, that's not a deficit. That's a strength. That new information being presented and altering the way you feel about a situation or react to a situation is not a bad thing. In fact, I think the bad thing is a person who is so stubborn that they're not able to understand that people can and should evolve in thought based on new information being presented. And so, especially as we think about the conflicts that we're in now, the conflicts that I fought in, the conflicts that I led paratroopers in, I think it would behoove us to repeatedly and systematically be able to think about these things with not just fresh eyes, but open hearts. Because if we're not learning lessons from things that we have done, positive and negative, if we're not being honest about things that we've seen because we're too worried about preserving legacies or what historians are going to say or whatever the case might be, then the long-term legacy and the long-term conclusions are never going to be what we hoped and never going to be what this country deserves. There are some real lessons learned from the past decade. There should be some real lessons learned over the past half century. And I hope our country and our leadership is mature enough to actually learn them. Thank you.
First of all, let me thank you for your service. I work for the Veterans Administration. I deal with claims. So I see a lot of the things coming back from the desert, like you said.
Yes, sir.
Particularly the invisible wounds. I served 30 years, Coast Guard Navy. Cool. I'm proud of my service. Never combat. Could kind of go home at night, if you will. But I have a question for you. When I read your book, The Other West, the thing that struck me, you did mention Colin Powell, and you mentioned his American journey. Yeah. And interestingly, as you well know, he spoke a lot about the racial context that he found himself in. Yeah. A young man from the Bronx, not unlike yourself. And you cited how that had been very inspirational. And it was certainly to me as well. So I would just ask you, I sort of joined the Coast Guard to avoid a draft notice. 1969, Vietnam, didn't want to go there. And
I understand.
Thank you. In the 30 years of service, in and out of reserve active, the racial issue, I saw a lot of maturation. I saw steps forward. I saw steps back. And I would just be curious, the question to you, when you served, looking back, and again, the context of Colin Powell, when he served, yeah. I remember vividly when he went down to Fort Hood, and he stated, back in the Bronx, we called everybody by all those N-word names and everything else, and it was just what we did in the hood. But he gets down to Fort Hood, and there was a racial wall that he ran into full force. Now, I'm of the opinion that we have taken great strides forward, that now a person of color, like a Colin Powell, can rise to the top, because like the cream, that's where they belong. But I would just be very curious, what did you observe when you went to Afghanistan in that regard?
Great question. Thank you, and thank you for your service. And thank you for your work. I would say, first, the only people that deserve the thanks aren't just necessarily the ones who saw combat. Anybody who knows what it's like to put on that uniform, and honestly, anybody who is even here stateside and domestic who is doing work on behalf of the betterment of this country deserves our thanks. So thank you for your service as well. So, it's interesting because there's actually even a scene that I talk about in the work where I was with our interpreter, and One thing that I learned also about the interpreters was that there are some people, particularly, you know, in where it says, like, okay, we're at war with the Afghan people, where it's like, you know, actually, some of the Afghan people who we're with were some of the bravest people that I met when I was in Afghanistan, i.e. our interpreter, our Turk. Because here was a person who, he was in every single combat operation we went on. He was right there with us. Right there standing next to us. The only difference was this, is that at the end of the night when we returned back to our FOBs, we returned back to our bases. No, sorry, FOBs are forward operating bases. He went back to his house. And oftentimes he would go back to his house and there would be letters when he'd wake up in the morning that'd be posted to his front door from the Taliban or from Haig or from whoever, basically saying, we know you're working with the Americans and we're going to kill you and your entire family. And he still showed up at work every morning. He showed up at work because he believed his father was actually killed by the Taliban. And he said, I want to do my part to make sure that our country is rid of them. So the amount of respect that I have for him and so many others is remarkable. The reason I bring him up, though, I remember when we would go out and he would talk to some Afghans and I'd ask him, say, what are they talking about? And he'd ask me the question. He said, you know, they want to know what country you're from. And he wasn't talking about the American forces. They were talking specifically about me. What country was I from? Because their idea and their impression of Americans were not me. And think about it, because in Afghanistan, you're talking about a country that has been in a constant state of war for 3 decades, a sporadic state of war for 200, right? And so they're used to forces being in and out of their country. They're used to Russians. They're used to Britain, the Brits. They're used to Americans. They're used to constantly other people in their country. But they were genuinely curious about, so what country is he from now? Who else is now in our country? And it really does kind of, you know, provide a greater context and a greater light on this very question. Where I was fascinated, because if you read the history of the civil rights movement and the history of World War II, and even some of the things that Colin Powell talked about, how you would have soldiers who were then returned from fighting overseas, like in World War II, and as they returned back, they would come back to segregated housing and eating at separate counters and drinking from separate water fountains, where they're almost like we were treated better in the countries that we were fighting. While you didn't come back to that in that same respect, there is no doubt that there is still work to be done. We didn't come back to separate food counters. We didn't come back to separate water fountains. 3 years after I redeployed and came back to the United States, we elected an African American to be our president. So there is no doubt how much progress has been made. But there's also still no doubt when you look at the fact that within criminal justice, within education, within health, within housing, within a myriad of different things, that disparities still exist. And I remember, and even as I think about what are some of the things that and how what we need to do to address that, it was actually something that Wes told me that I thought actually added the greatest amount of context to it. When, you know, I was speaking with Wes and we were talking about East Baltimore, and I asked him, I said, so do you think that we're products of our environments? Because that's what I always thought when I grew up, that people were products of their environments, and I heard that so many times that I never questioned it anymore. People are products of their environments. And Wes looked at me and he said, actually, I think we're products of our expectations. And I thought to myself, he is absolutely right. That we are not products of our environments. We're products of our expectations. And someone once said to me, it's a real shame that you lived up to your expectations and Wes didn't. And I said, actually, the real shame is that we both did. Because the expectations that people have of themselves don't come from nowhere. The expectations that people have of themselves come from the expectations that other people have of them. And they just simply internalize them and they make them their own. And so while we've got a collection of different gaps in the society, education gaps, digital gaps, housing gaps, all the things that I discussed and talked about, health gaps, I think, the most dangerous gap that we have in our society and the most nefarious gap we have in our society is still the expectation gap. That we just expect different things from different people depending on where they grew up, depending on who their parents are, depending on what they look like, depending on what the history in this country is. We expect different things. So while we have made a tremendous amount of progress in this country, that this country honestly should be very proud of, to say that we don't have work to do still, and to say that the expectation gap is not at the crux of that work, I think would be to be naive as well. And to be disingenuous, and not to be intellectually honest, and also to be disrespectful to the amount of work that we have already made thus far. So, thank you. Thank you.
Like others, I'll thank you for your inspiring presentation.
I can't
agree more that work is what matters. I would like you to say a little more about what your work today is. What is the work for you right now?
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you. And I'd love to talk about that. So in addition to things like, you know, I believe in the power of story. I believe in the ability to share ideas and that, you know, and actually I really have a more quantitative mind than qualitative mind. But I believe that while stats can add context, that it's stories that promote action. Because that's what people don't forget. You know, you can give me stat, and again, I studied this, so it's like, you know, you can give me a stat on anything, and if you give me 5 minutes, I can find a stat that can completely counter your stat. And both will be right, right? I mean, that's the irony of statistics. But you don't forget the humanity behind things. And so I think much of the things, the work we do now, that has to be interlaced in everything. But the big thing that we're working on now is helping to address the educational challenges that we have in this country, specifically looking at what's happening within higher education. Because we're actually doing a better job nationally of getting kids through high school. Nationally, for the first time last year, 80% of kids in high school actually ended up receiving a high school degree. 80%. It's a huge accomplishment, and it's a great number, especially when you consider the fact that 16 years ago, the number was 57%. Right? So huge strides that we've seen over the past two decades. However, the number of students as they head into higher education who actually complete is unbelievably stubborn. The number is for students who start college every single year. Now, again, you know, the average year for a freshman and the average definition of a freshman has changed, all that kind of stuff. But for every student that starts college every single year, 34% will not either complete their freshman year or will not re-enroll for their sophomore year. So we're losing a lion's share of these students in the first two semesters of college, many of whom will not even make it past Thanksgiving. And there's a couple different reasons for it. There's, you have three real main reasons and three main buckets. One is financial. So for the students who start college, can't afford school. But the ironic thing is this. For students who are truly lower income and first generation and military veterans, et cetera, because of things like Pell Grants, GI Bill, GAG Grants, et cetera, that is a real reason. But it's not the majority reason why they don't finish. Biggest reasons are the last two. One is academic remediation. So kids who are finishing high school but are still not prepared for college-level work. And so what ends up happening is this. A student will then go on to college and then take a series of remedial courses. Here's the problem with remedial courses. They cost the same amount as an average freshman, except it's worth nothing. So when a student is coming in and taking 081 English or 081 math, that student will pay $5,000, $8,000, $10,000, $15,000, whatever the cost of that college is, and by the end of that first year, they'll have 6, 3, no credits. That student, I can tell you right now, the chances of them actually finishing college are extraordinarily slim. Also considering the fact that at some point financial aid runs out. So you only have but so many years to finish school before your financial aid bill comes out, and then your bill, which used to be $1,300 for the year, now jumps to $13,000 for the year, or whatever the case is. That's one. The second thing is the social transition. Is that for many students, because of the fact that we have 476 kids per guidance counselor in this country, in California the number is 715 kids per guidance counselor, that you have many kids who are either undershooting, you have many kids who are selecting the wrong schools, you have many kids who aren't asking the right questions when it comes to schools, and then for many of them, when they walk into a college campus, they immediately walk onto that college campus and they say to themselves, I don't belong here. I'm not welcomed here. I don't know who to talk to. And then for many students, within months, they're home. And so what we basically said was, understanding those and understanding those facts and that reality for so many students, if we know that the choke point for most students is that freshman year, because all statistics show that if a student does well their freshman year, they have a much higher propensity of both finishing college and finishing on time. If we know that the choke point for many students is that freshman year, then why don't we reinvent the freshman year? Totally change it. Change the entire structure of the freshman year so we can provide a softer on-ramp for students as they're making. So the platform that I'm running with a group of people is a platform called Bridge EDU, where we work with colleges and universities, now starting off in Maryland, but eventually continuing to broaden out to other colleges around the country, where in addition to changing the academic calendar, so the students are only taking 1 to 2 classes at a time because we want to focus on mastery of a subject area. And they're taking them in 9-week chunks instead of full semesters. So the student's not just walking on a college campus where someone's saying, hey, by the way, here's your 5 classes and I wish you the best of luck, which is what often happens for college freshmen. That they're taking 1 to 2 classes at a time in 9-week sections. But they're also doing personalized and tailored internships and service learning inside of their own home communities. And they're also provided a whole co-curriculum that is providing them extra assets and extra supports that can better help them to exceed and excel in their collegiate process. Part of the reason why adding those things became important was this. We also have a social capital problem when it comes to higher education, where for some students who finish up college, they can easily transition off into X job or Y job because they know who to contact and they know what that process is like. But if I'm the average parent in East Seattle, if I'm the average parent in West Baltimore, if I'm the average parent in South Side of Chicago, and I would love for my child to have an internship at Microsoft, or I'd love for my child to have an internship at Under Armour, or I'd love for my child to have an internship at the Chicago Museum of Art, who do I call about that? Who do I talk to? They don't have that level of social capital. So what we want to do in the entire collegiate process is infuse that into the lives of the students and also help them understand what it means and how do you nurture it. And so we have our grouping of students now, and it's actually ironic because we've got some students in our class and our cohorts that are from Baltimore City Public Schools, and we've got some that are from Baltimore City Independent and Private Schools. We've got some students who are now for third or fourth generation in their family to go to college. And we've got some students that they are the first one in their entire block who's ever walked onto a college campus. We've got some students that are 18 years old and fresh out of high school, and we've got some students that are 23 or 24 years old who now have 3 dependents, and this is their second shot. And in some, their third shot. But all of them have one thing in common. They were looking for a different way of thinking about higher education, and we're incredibly proud to say that they're all doing well. There is a way to rethink this process of higher education, especially if we're actually serious about it. If we want to make a real argument about the importance of higher education, if we want to talk about the importance of higher education in 21st century jobs, if we want to talk about all this kind of stuff, and we're serious about it, then we also then need to alter a structure to make sure it shows that we're serious about it. Because if you think about the history of college, college historically has only been for 20% of the population. That's how college was created, that 20% of the population were supposed to go into higher education, 80% were not, right? Around 4 or 5 decades ago, we made the decision nationally that we want to change that and open up higher education to all people. So we introduced things like the GI Bill. We introduced things like the Pell Grants. We introduced all this kind of stuff and try to open up opportunities. The challenge, though, is that we never change the structure. Hence why we have so many people who have difficulty navigating that transition. And so when I think about my work and I think about the work of our team, this is a needle that we're going to move. This is a needle that we want to move for not just our own individual students, but about the whole psychology and how we think about this transition in higher education. And not just because it's good for those individual students that they can actually complete and complete on time, but because it's good for our nation if we're going to be serious about the importance of actually making collegiate completion and or skill building in some way, shape, or form something that every single student has an opportunity to see. Because, you know, truthfully, if for the average kid in Baltimore, if you don't have any some type of advanced degree or some type of training, skill set, advanced degree, anything, you have a better chance of spending the majority of your adult life incarcerated than you do gainfully employed. That can't stand. And that's not right, it's not fair, and it's not good for any of us. So that's my work. That's what we spend our time on, and that's what we plan on getting done. So thank you.
Hi, Wes. I think you may have already answered my question, possibly, partly, but before I ask my question, I just want to say that it's really amazing to have you here. And I, you know, as a college grad of a couple years who's been, you know, the last 3 years or so kind of struggling to really know what to do with my life and what directions to take, you know, I it meant a lot to be here and to, you know, hear your experiences and your wisdom. I'm a college grad. I went to a school just north of here up in the town of Bellingham. I'm not sure you've heard of it or not. It's a, you know, a smaller state school. And what you just said in your last statement, I kind of related to of the problem of maybe not enough social capital. And it's not that my school is actually considered a very good school. You know, and I'm not going to say that it was all my institution's problem. I think a lot of the problem came from me, where I kind of struggled with this, you know, disillusionment and just confusion of what I was meant to do, and maybe didn't take all the steps that I could have taken to talk to advisors as much about internships or whatever. But I came from an environmental studies background, and I'm currently in and out of, you know, school, hoping to get into solar work. You know, I get this feeling that renewable energy and renewable technologies are really a future, and I'm motivated to go in that direction. So for that reason, you know, I'm 29 years old. I'm still kind of searching to, you know, figure out what direction I want to take. But, you know, my question to you is, what motivated you to serve in Afghanistan? You sound like a very decorated individual. You've gone in many directions, but what was the main motivation that made you want to, you know, serve in Afghanistan?
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for that question. And even before I come back to that, let me say, you know, first of all, you're not alone in the fact that, hey, I finished school and I'm not sure exactly what I want to do yet. That is the vast majority of people who are finishing school. Yeah. And I'm being very, very honest. I mean, like, and so another true stat is that for people that graduated last year from school, the number's now 39, but 39% of them are currently either unemployed or underemployed. And part of it, again, it's not your fault, and it's not like I'm blaming higher education, but higher education doesn't see that as necessarily their responsibilities, right? Their responsibility is to issue degrees. So they have like career placement offices that if you choose to walk in those doors, you can walk in, and if you choose not to, you choose not to. But that's kind of has been higher ed's approach to the placement. So I simply say, don't sweat it. You are not alone. And honestly, so much of this was really for a decade me kind of going through that process of trying to figure out, okay, I've studied here and I've done this and I'm still not sure exactly what I'm supposed to use that, right? The thing about Afghanistan was interesting because when I first received the Rhodes Scholarship, we left for Oxford on September 23rd of 2001. So we were actually one of the first transatlantic flights that was even allowed to go after they shut down airspace. And I remember actually contacting the military afterwards and saying that, you know, I wanted to forego my scholarship and, you know, I want to go back, because I knew that within months that my soldiers who I'd been training with and that kind of thing were now getting ready to deploy, and I was getting ready to head overseas too, but I was getting ready to go have high tea and drink port, right? And I remember the military was like, listen, don't worry about it. We're going to get our pound of flesh. You go do what you need to do and you go study and that kind of thing. But it was always a gut-wrenching feeling that kind of sat over me the whole time, was that while I was having this amazing experience, which I was incredibly thankful for, that while I was having that experience, my soldiers were overseas fighting. And so, you know, when you wear it with a military uniform on your shoulder, there's a patch that after you go into combat that you put on the patch, and the patch is always the unit that you fought with. And I remember as I even went back with the 82nd, as I was walking around Fort Bragg, the searing look that I got from people who, when they saw that I had nothing on my arm, and all of them were at that point on their fourth, fifth deployments, and here I am with a bare shoulder. I went, as most soldiers who actually feel like, you know, especially while you're over there and you serve, as many soldiers while you serve, because of the love affair that I have with my soldiers, with the fact that I fought because there were people to my left and people to my right who deserved to get home. There were people to my left and to my right who deserved to see their families again. That's why we served. It wasn't because of a larger social, political, geopolitical, all that kind of stuff. And what was interesting is that, you know, I even think about a lot of my soldiers, you know, one of the conversations I would have with all of them as we were loading up and mounting up and getting ready to deploy is that I'd ask them, what are you guys doing here? Like, what brought you here? And when I joined the military in 1998. And to be honest, I joined right out of high school. And to be honest, there was really nothing going on, at least for an infantry officer, in 1998. I mean, I joined with two assurances. One was that the Army would pay for college, which is great. And the other one was that we probably wouldn't see combat. Those are the two assurances that I thought about as I signed up for the military. And obviously, 3 years later, at least they paid for college, right? But for all my soldiers, it was different. These are people who finished up high school, many of them, who finished up high school, some cases finished up college. And they were now heading over to Assadabad and Jalalabad and Khost and Tikrit and to Baghdad. Into places where for many of them, they couldn't even point that on a map 8 months earlier. And for a lot of them, they were doing it because of a sense of, you know, 9/11 was a sense that they felt like it was their time to do something, that they wanted to do something, that they wanted to serve. And that was a sense of courage that I don't even think I fully grasped or fully understood or could have said even the same thing. And that was incredibly not just humbling but inspiring to me. I joined at a time of peace, at a time of relative peace, right? They didn't. They joined with a full understanding of what they were signing up for. And part of that was, I think, one of the things that really helped me to fall in love with my soldiers the way that I did and the love affair that I still have with them to this day. And so when I often think about, you know, kind of like, you know, why Afghanistan, or how do you feel about Afghanistan versus Iraq and was Afghanistan, all this kind of stuff, I can say with a completely honest heart that while we were overseas fighting, that doesn't really come up. What I'm thinking about is Johnson and Zook and Fenzel and Bryant's and Meister and Collins, and all of them, they deserve to get home. And so I was going to do my best to make sure that they could do just that.
Okay. So it was fulfilling a sense of duty and a camaraderie and a greater purpose, the greater purpose for service and duty.
It was. It was that. It was, you know, it was also, you know, I kind of look at it kind of like an analogy in football. You know, we're in football season now, so it's kind of like a football analogy where it's like, you know, you go through preseason and then it's like week one and you're sitting on the sidelines. And that's very much when I would, you know, the example I was talking about with my sleeve, right? It's like we all go through preseason together. We're all training. We're all doing all this stuff. And then it's game time and I'm not on the field. And I wanted to get on the field. And so I think that was one of the fascinating things about even when Mike called me and told me that. And then I decided to leave finance and go back into the military. There was a whole this cacophony of emotions and of feelings, but all of them led to one answer, and that was go serve. I understood what I was asking. I understood what I was getting myself into. I understood the risks. I understood what I was asking my family to do. And despite all of that, with all those things, there was only one answer that for me that made sense for a collection of those different reasons, and that was get over there.
Yeah, so thank you for your service. And the last thing I'll say is that I'm living at home working with my family, but I have these ambitions to follow in this renewable energy direction. So I just want to say it was inspiring to hear your talk, and it really was, for me, it really meant a lot. So
bless you, man. And I just say, too, not only is that an incredibly exciting space, an exciting area to be in, if you find something kind of, again, going back to the definition where you're greatest interests and joys and passions are intersecting and overlapping with the world's greatest needs, then you have found your work. I can't think of, you know, there's a whole lot of areas where not just where our country is going and where it needs to, not just country, but world is going where it needs to go, and where we need to make sure that we're having incredibly smart and bright people who are on the forefront of that. That's some pretty good work to find yourself in. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
I was impressed by some of the things you said about education, about expectations. So give me another question.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell, can you figure out what is the difference in your upbringing versus the upbringing of the other West? I mean, what made, I think that it's not just one thing, it's not just ambition that is different, the difference between you. Maybe it's the amount of intelligence, the perspective of the parent, the one parent. I just wonder if you can speak about it a little bit.
Bless you, and thank you for that. And first, let me say, I really appreciated the fact that you said, you know, I don't think that it's that there is like one thing, because I wholeheartedly agree with you. In fact, so true story. I remember someone came up to me. I guess it's about 13 months ago, but they said, you know, I just want to let you know I didn't like your book. And I said that's fine. I said, if you don't mind me asking, what did you like about it? And they said to me, they said, because I felt like throughout the book you tell the story of these two kids, and you tell about their journey. And at the end of it, when it came time for you to answer the question, what's the one thing that we can do to help a child go one way, help a child go another way, you don't give an answer. And I said to them, I said, you know, and with all due respect, I'm sorry that you didn't like my answer. I'm just not sure if I love the question. And I told them, because as you correctly said, I told them because I don't think there is a one thing. Right? I mean, raising kids is amazingly complicated. And when you happen to raise kids in some of the most precarious communities of our country, it is that much more complicated. I will debate with anybody who wants to tell me that every child is born with the same amount of assets. Because if there's anybody who really does believe that, there are some communities in this city alone that I would love to take you to and hear you make that same argument. Right? I'm a firm believer that potential in this country is universal. Opportunity is not. And the difference, the space between potential and where we can all end up, is where we all can collectively come in. So it would be, I think, as we're talking about some of the differences that we have, you know, between Wes, and one thing I always say about Wes is that, and I think you see it in the way I actually even try to talk about him, both in the other Wes Moore and as I talk about him publicly, Wes has made some horrific decisions in his life, and he knows that. Wes has made some unforgiving and some unforgivable decisions in his life, and he knows that. But Wes is no dummy. I would actually say, and I'm not saying this to be glib, I actually think Wes probably has more innate talent and intelligence than I ever did coming up. Wes is actually a really smart guy who's made some really bad decisions. I mean, let's just take, and again, I'm in no way justifying what he did. But this is a guy who, when he was 15 years old, was running a pretty complex drug operation in East Baltimore. And again, not justifying the action, but think about this. This is a person at that age is then responsible with the moving of tens of thousands of dollars before lunchtime. This is a person who's also doing all of this, and he's doing all the numbers in his head. Why? Because if a cop grabs you, you want nothing in your pockets. It's not like he's walking around with a calculator. So he's calculating all this stuff in his head. He's like, okay, boy, 15, 15. And I'll say, oh, wait, wait. You're $17 short. And this is kind of a business where numbers matter. And they kind of take their numbers seriously. You can't just be like, oh, man, I missed a zero. Like, it kind of doesn't work like that. He's doing this in his head. And I just can't help but think about, imagine if there... if he had figured out a way, and we collectively had figured out that way, of steering that intelligence in a different place, had we essentially changed the product, what he could be doing. And so while I think it becomes, you know, while I think there is never going to be a one thing, I think understanding the role that family plays in it is important, even though, again, I would say, you know, I love my mother with all my heart, and I still think the greatest gift that God ever gave me was the fact that Joy Moore gave birth to me, and it's something that I had zero responsibility for, right? But I also know that my mother didn't love us a drop more than Wes's mother loved her kids. Not a drop. Wes's mother bleeds for her children. And Wes's mother also was one day watching the news and found out what had happened to her two sons when, as they were describing this crime and the murder of Sergeant Prothero, as they were talking about the four people that the police were looking for in connection, two of the faces that looked back at her from the television screen were her two sons. That's how she found out about this. I also know that we cannot even understand this without understanding the role that education plays. Wes's mother was the first one in her family to go to college. She graduated from Baltimore City Community College with honors, and then she got accepted at Johns Hopkins University. She does two semesters at Johns Hopkins University, and one day she receives a letter indicating that her grants were cut, and she knew that she could no longer afford to go to school. And I can't help but think how different her life could have been had she had the chance to finish college. And it's not because of the piece of paper. It's not because of the thing we get to frame and throw up on a wall. It's not because we get to change, you know, our LinkedIn profile, right? It's because as you move up in education, as we were talking about earlier, your networks are going to change. Your friendships are going to change. Your connections are going to change. I know if I took a quick straw poll, and I'd be the very first one to raise my hand of, you know, people either working now or working in recent history, if you did not get your job through the classified ads or through Monster.com. Because that's not the way this game works. This game works because one day you're going to get a phone call or an email from somebody who says, I'm looking for someone that can do X, Y, or Z, and we have a mutual friend, and they suggested that I talk to you. So I think if by understanding the role that all these things, how they all marry together, the combination of both personal responsibility and societal responsibility, the combination of how education and how housing and how expectations and how all these things play together, that all matters. And I think it's important then to see how they played into the lives of these two kids, but how honestly how they play into all of our lives.
Did you have better circumstances? I mean, did you have people who supported you, admired you, mentored you throughout your childhood, earlier childhood? I come from a background of preschool teaching, so I believe in early education.
Oh, so do I.
Yeah, okay.
I believe deeply in the importance of early education. I think I definitely did. I think what I also, but again, even I think as Wes would say, there were people in his life who cared. I think that oftentimes, though, it took him a bit longer to understand it and appreciate it. I think also something that happened, because even, you know, you'll see in the other Westmore, I got in trouble in the juvenile justice system, and I got sent to military school when I was 13 years old. I had a mandatory year. And while I hated every minute of it when I first showed up, I ran away 5 times in the first 4 days. Truly, I did. But I think one thing that also happened there that became really important was they injected leadership into my life, a sense of positive leadership that actually mattered, and I fell in love with this sense of graduated leadership that military and the military school introduced to me. And it's funny because I was speaking with someone about the work we do with kids in the juvenile justice system, and someone said to me how complicated gangs are. And at first I agreed, but then I was like, you know what, that's actually not true. I said, there's nothing complicated about them, quite honestly. I said, the only thing they have done is they've taken the same structure of every military organization and every Fortune 500 company, and they've made them their own. I mean, when you really think about it, when they were recruiting us at 9 years old, they weren't recruiting us to be kingpins. They were recruiting us to be lookouts. And our job was to stand on a corner and yell out at whatever the name of the day was, or you know, just because, you know, hey, Susie, Rhonda, whenever you saw a cop car roll by or someone who didn't look like they belong. And the reason you yell names out is because if a cop grabs you, you can simply say, get your hands off of me, since when is it a crime to yell for my friend? And it's not, and the cop lets you go. And then from there, you graduate, and you become a runner. Your job is to move a package from one side of town to another side of town. The reason they recruited us at 9 and 10 and 11 years old to do that is because cops generally don't check 9 and 10 and 11-year-olds with book bags. And then from there, you graduate, and you become a cash kid, or you become a houseman, or you become muscle, or you become a lieutenant, or you become... And so what happens is that kids are going to learn. Going back to your point, the question is, who's teaching them and what are they learning? But they're going to figure it out, and they're going to find a way to get involved. So it's better that we get them involved early in things that are actually God-honoring and redeeming. Thank you.
We are unfortunately out of time for any more questions, but you can talk to Wes at the book signing table when you get your book signed.
Okay. Thank you all so much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It helps more people find us. Wes Moore's new book is The Work, My Search for a Meaningful Life. Town Hall Seattle, Elliott Bay Book Company, and the Northwest African American Museum presented this event on January 19, 2015, as part of the Civic Series. Sponsors included Boeing, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Thanks again to Anna Tatashev for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. We'll be right back.